You can hear our show on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. You're watching Fanboy Versus with your hosts, J.D. Church, Nicole Hale, Chris Triplett, and Chris McFeely.
And you are watching Fanboy Versus. I am your host, J.D., joined by Nicole and Chris McFeely, who have completely destroyed by talking about a new upcoming character that XV and I created. Babesar!
Interesting, new one.
Speed of a sloth. So, it's what?
I don't know.
So Chris Triplett is not here. I have decided that whenever one of my fellow hosts are not here, I am going to randomly replace them with a picture of my choosing. This week, Chris Triplett will be played by Ted Kord, who does not have a hole in his head at this point, so he should be glad for that.
I like it. It's cute.
Chris McFeely has been crying on the floor. He's okay now. All right.
I'm okay.
So we're back from our 100th episode, which was a lot of fun. I think it went well.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it's everything. I really thought that the whole barber thing was gonna like epic fail on me in some way, and it went all right. I was happy. Yeah,
I enjoyed it. John Barber was awesome.
Yeah, it was great. He was great. No, I was just imagining that it was like something would break or I wouldn't have it in the right place or something. It was like, oh, we're doing this a lot. This is going to be. So it was a lot of fun. So we thank John again for coming
on.
Fun show. So I am still horribly behind on comics, by the way. Let's see if I could show for the class. If you don't have video, I'm sorry, but this is the current stack of comics that I still have to read. But I'm caught up, at least for stuff that came out this week. So, cool stuff this week with Night of the Owls getting started. So, yeah, but those are mostly trades and stuff, though, right? They're not, like, comic books.
I fail because I still need to read Spider Island.
Hot. Chris McFeely has enough reading. You know what? I imagine that someday Chris McFeely will... The world will end, and he'll be the only person left, and he'll be like,
there was
yes,
time now.
No, I just picture, you know, there's someone decides to come smoking in McFeely's house, and it just goes up in flames.
God, there was time.
There was time now. God. It's not fair.
I don't know what it is. That is such a gripping deal because there must be just a lot of just empathy with that story because it sort of persists for some reason.
Oh, there's a lot of Twilight Zone.
Even though that guy was a total asshole.
Yeah,
I mean, it's Twilight Zone, but that's the whole thing with it is like, the guy was a total asshole, so you really should, at the end, you should be like,
he wasn't an asshole. He was a milquetoast. He was bullied by everybody around
him. I thought
him,
that he was
bullied
kind of
by his wife at home. He was just a weed.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it's been too long since I saw that part. So, anyway.
Just confusing he wasn't playing the penguin in that one.
See,
that's where you're mixing it up.
He
did not commit umbrella-themed crime.
Oh, well. My mistake. So, what else is going on?
Hi.
What's going on this
How
week?
How are you?
Yeah.
Tell us more about Babestar.
Babestar! Babestar! Brother said I could do reviews this week. Let's talk about puppy comics.
Babestar!
He said not to use my bad eyes, though.
But Huey's tried not to laugh. Look at him. He's tried not to laugh.
God. For more on the adventures of Braves, XR, follow him on Twitter.
Okay, time to get serious. We're talking comics.
Yeah, this is serious stuff, folks.
This is serious business.
Yeah, this is not any kind of joking around stuff. You know, we don't want to make up fake characters to talk about in funny ways. This is totally not funny because it's horribly wrong. Yeah.
So wrong.
It's so wrong and yet funny. Okay, so news then, Chris. What is the news that we have?
The news is I just found this little plastic missile on the floor, and I don't know what it goes to.
That is so vital right now.
Oh,
I can't.
Man, it probably goes on one of these power core combiners.
I can't tell you how vitally important that is to this show.
I know. I was hoping the listening audience could figure it out from my description of it.
Yeah, missile? That's very descriptive, sir.
So there is some news.
Does it look
yeah,
like my
right.
Viacon?
Yeah, right. Mine's upstairs. So
Nicole and I have Viacons, by the way. We just
Yay.
Thought everyone should know that.
Yeah, Terry is transformed and alive.
Terry?
Unlike,
Terry?
Yeah, I need some Terry. Terry the Viacon.
Terry,
you know?
All right, cool.
You got Bob the Insecticon. I just said his name's Terry.
Well, you do kind of want sort of basic folksy names for Larry,
Jeff. Well, so you got three different types of Viacons. So we got Terry, Jerry, and Barry. So you got
that
Terry.
That only works if you're American, though.
Yeah.
See, Terry. I would have Terry, Jerry, and Barry. It doesn't work with when you don't have an American accent.
Mm. See, Terry is the car, and Jerry's the jet, and Barry is the miner.
Ah.
There you go.
Okay.
See Barry, because he buries, he digs.
I see what you did there.
You see, I see what you did there, but no, because it's Barry.
And Barry.
If you're on the other side of the Atlantic, it doesn't work quite the same. It's funny how that goes.
Signals all right, so reach. What's in the news this week, folks?
Well,
let's see. Well, the Avengers broke $1 billion this week.
Ooh! $1 billion dollars.
$1 billion, meaning me. It's friggin' ridiculous, eh? It is now the 11th highest grossing film ever after 2 weeks.
God.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That is going to fly up that chart.
God.
That is stupid.
Yeah.
That is.
That's bigger than Transformers. It's not
Dark of the Moon. Dark of the Moon is the fourth highest grossing film ever. That is stupid. I can't process that. Could it be bigger than Dark of the Moon? I don't see it being bigger than Avatar or Titanic or whichever one of the Potter films the third one is.
Yeah.
But let me just pull up the list and see what it's actually standing in its way. One moment. Highest grossing. I know that one is Avatar, of course, and two is Titanic.
God, I hate that. That just.
I know. Those will never be dislodged, because Avatar's gross is 2.7.
It's all your fault, people.
Titanic's is 2.2 billion, thereabouts. Thereabouts, I'm saying. And, of course, it's got its 3D re-release right now. Deathly Hallows Part 2 has 1.3 billion. Wow. Dark of the Moon has 1.1 billion. And, progressively, it's Return of the King, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Toy Story 3, On Stranger Tides, The Phantom Menace, Alice in Wonderland, and The Avengers.
Wow.
It say how many actual ticket sales they've had?
It does not.
Yeah.
Because nobody bothers inflation, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All I can think about is that scene from Robot Chicken where James Cameron does the dolphin thing in the ocean of money, and he's like, or, or.
I know that one.
Yeah. So that's
because
great.
Ticket sales-wise, it's still Gone with the Wind is number one, and Star Wars is number two.
Yeah, well, Star Wars
is
a
nobody tracks that now.
Yes.
Nobody tracks it now. It's all about
so
the
we'll
money.
Keep our eyes on it. Because I saw it for a second time this week. It is still awesome.
I saw it for a third time, and I enjoyed it just as much as the first two.
I need to see it again. I've only done the one, so.
You call yourself a fan?
Hey. Whoa.
That's joking.
Okay. All right, other news.
Well, let's see what else going on this week.
Arrow.
Yes, that was literally. I was just looking at it in front of me. Believe it or not, CW has picked up Sherwood. Arrow.
God, I wish it was Sherwood though. That would be so much cooler.
I think they should take our idea.
Yes, this is the Green Arrow series. They've picked it up for a series. They did a pilot, and it's been picked up for a series.
Nice.
Holy God. No, don't forget, this has been created by the screenwriters of Green Lantern.
That's gonna be on my tombstone. Green Lantern wasn't that bad.
Nicole Hale. Green Lantern wasn't that bad.
And then just in graffiti underneath. Yes, it was.
And yes, many other wrong things were said in her lifetime.
After a violent shipwreck, billionaire playboy Oliver Queen was missing and presumed dead for 5 years before being discovered alive on a remote island in the Pacific. When he returns home to Starling City. Starling City, that's what they're calling it. His devoted mother Moira, much beloved sister Thea, I don't know. And best friend Tommy, welcome Tommy, yeah, because that was a famous supporting cast from the Green Lantern comics there. Welcome him home, but they sense Oliver has been changed by his ordeal on the island. While Oliver hides the truth about the man he's become, he desperately wants to make amends for the actions he took as the boy he was. Most particularly, he seeks reconciliation with his former girlfriend, Laurel Lance. As Oliver reconnects with those closest to him, he secretly creates the persona of Arrow, a vigilante to right the wrongs of his family, fight the ills of society, and restore Starling City to its former glory. By day, Oliver plays the role of a wealthy, carefree, and careless philanderer he used to be, flanked by his devoted chauffeur and bodyguard, John Diggle, while carefully... What the fuck? While carefully concealing the secret identity, he turns to the undercover of darkness. However, Laurel's father, Detective Quentin Lance, is determined... This is our show! This is our show, and they
They stole our idea!
They did!
Quentin Lance is determined to arrest the vigilante operating in his city. Meanwhile, Oliver's own mother Moira knows much more about the deadly shipwreck than she let on, and is more ruthless than he could ever imagine.
Damn it. Where's my money?
Yeah.
Where is our money? That's... Damn it.
Here is set star Stephen Amell from Hung in the Vampire Diaries as Oliver Queen. Colin Donnell as Tommy Merlin.
Merlin?
Merlin, the Black Archer, Green Arrow's greatest enemy, is his best friend as a chap. Fucking Smallville!
Wow.
It sounds like it's just
Tommy Merlin. Are you... What? Whoa, oh my God. Okay. Kate Cassidy from Supernatural.
Benstar doesn't understand.
As Laurel Lent. David Ramsey from Dexter and Blue Bloods is John Diggle. Willa Holland for the OC is...
Who said Diggle?
Thea Queen. Susanna Thompson from Deep Space Nine and Kings as Moira Queen, and Paul Blackthorne from the Dresden Files as Detective Quentin Lance.
Okay, never mind. I'm not watching this series.
Yeah, wow. His best friend is the guy who will become his archenemy. And you just made his surname Merlin, but like it has a Y. But I mean, it has a Y in the comics, but it's like... Whoa.
Wow. Hmm. Well, I mean, I might catch it, I guess, and see.
Well, he has a beard. I mean,
but he's something. But they're just calling the guy Arrow, not Green Arrow.
Yeah, he's not Green Arrow. It's not just that they haven't just called the show Arrow or something. No, they carry. It seems like he'll be Arrow in the thing, and his mother is the bad guy, and his girlfriend's dad is the police detective who must hunt him. So that's Spider-Man,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh God.
Spider-Man plus Smallville equals Arrow.
Although, well, and Bruce, there's a little bit of Bruce Wayne in there. The rich, what? You know. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, I guess it's the CW. What can you hope for?
Yeah. I don't want to wait.
Somebody save me. Marvel has teased something called the first X-Man for August. Don't know what it is. It is literally just a one-page advert for something in August that says
Apocalypse.
The first X-Man. We don't know what it is. Shrug.
Right?
That's, no? Yeah, I don't know. Is it just going to turn out Professor X had another team before he had a team, maybe? Wouldn't be surprising. It's funny that it's dropping in the middle of AVX, but there you go. What else happened this week? A couple of minor creative announcements. Cullen Bunn is going to be taking over Venom from Rick Remender, which is not too surprising because Remender's got a busy slate as it is right now, writing Secret Avengers and Uncanny X-Force. So Cullen Bunn, he's been busy at Marvel lately. You know, he's writing Wolverine at the minute. He wrote the Fearless miniseries and taking over Venom now as well. Hopefully it'll continue its popularity under him. DC has announced there's going to be a Phantom Lady miniseries, which is an
sexy.
Odd one. But they did do one of the Ray not so very long ago, and the Ray and Phantom Lady are both Freedom Fighters, so maybe they're planning something with the Freedom Fighters.
Ooh.
Perhaps. I guess that's about all of the business-related news, but we do have to pause a moment and share also the sad news this week on the passing of Tony DeZuniga, who was the co-creator of Jonah Hex.
Yep.
Yeah, died this week at 79 years of age. One of those just sad situations where he suffered a stroke, heart failure, and brain damage. So it was, yeah. One of those situations where the Hero Initiative, I believe, stepped in to try and help pay the medical bills and everything. But I think whenever you have the hat trick there, there's not a lot that can be done there. That's just...
Yeah, that's really hard to overcome.
Making him comfortable, I think, in the end. So that, and you know, the thing about DeZuniga, actually, compared to some of the other sad deaths we've had to report, is that he was still really working. You know, he put out a Jonah Hex graphic novel with Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray just last year, I think.
Oh, wow.
You know, so he was still working, so it is always sad whenever somebody who's still in the business like that passes, but he leaves a strong legacy as somebody creating a character who's still, you know, we just had a film, terrible film, but you know,
but it was
so
a film, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, leaves us with a character who's still, you know, viable and still in use like that, which is something. C'est la vie.
Yes.
That's about all the news this week.
You know, I want to mention one thing. Every once in a while, I mention stuff I read off of DC Women Kicking Ass. Of course, we can't miss that we're recording this on Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all the moms that are out there. I thought it was interesting, though. She mentioned that, you know, every year she sort of does like a, you know, Moms of DC thing because that's her trick. Little light on moms this year out of DC after the New 52. And some of it's just an artifact of the reboot and everything's kind of starting over fresh. But, you know, some of the moms that you would sort of think of, you know, I think Ma Kent has usually been around. She's not. She's dead in the universe now. Other moms, you know, are gone. Black Canary, I don't think, is really a mom anymore. Kind of odd. Interesting. It made me wonder, is like, you know, part of this, is it an artifact of the reboot or an artifact of just like an intentional thing where they've sort of subtracted a lot of the family stuff out of the DC? You know, it's sort of, I guess they've re-injected a little bit of it with bringing in Earth 2 and stuff now, which I have not read yet. I don't know. It's kind of an interesting question. Chicken or the egg sort of thing, I guess.
I doubt it was deliberate.
No.
Just an unfortunate side effect.
Yeah, I mean, well, especially starting back at the beginning, you've got a lot of characters that have been sort of de-aged. They really haven't had time to, you know, grow into those sort of roles, you know, yet, or been around long enough to do those sort of things. I mean, you really think we're dealing with, you know, really only about 5 years of history. like sort of. Now that, although it's still sort of perplexing with the Bat Family, where it's like you've crammed four Robins into 5 years.
It's a one-year program.
It's a one-year program, and you sort of hang out, but not. And yeah.
1 year without a Robin, and then 1 year on for all the others.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
I guess we got Barbara Gordon's mom showing up.
Yeah, that's the one major mom.
Yeah. that's the big mom that's around right now. But, of course, you know, that wasn't dealt with. We are going to talk about Batgirl later in the show. Nicole and I are going to review that at the end of the show. Ooh. Night of Owls. Ooh. Starting, yes.
Wow.
Brian didn't like Batman. But I've
I don't know what's wrong with Brian.
I'm beginning to think that Brian is just wrong.
I think Brian hit his head really hard at some point.
He wasn't real hot on Avengers, and he was totally wrong about that.
No.
And
did something come into the middle of the night, Brian, and just suck your soul?
Yeah.
Because, you know.
Yeah. And now he's wrong about Batman as well. He said that the whole Court of Owls thing has gone on too long. He's really
No, I love this Court of Owls.
Possibly have gone on too long. It's not gone on for any length of time at all yet.
Yeah, so it's okay. It's Brian Kilby's wrong, folks.
Well, I guess it started with Talon, the Talon thing with the reboot.
Yeah, but it was only the beginning, you know. They've only just put the book out of that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's still just going. So we're good. It's okay. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. So, cool. Anyway, all right, well, that was a horrible discussion. I'm glad I brought up the Mother's Day topic. all right, well, I guess we'll review stuff then.
Right.
Yeah, I like comics.
Babe, so I love comics.
I like comics.
Yeah, it's totally
comics.
Right.
It's not right.
Yeah.
What the hell? Jesus.
It is totally XV and I's fault. So.
Yeah.
And Bavesaur is now making appearances in all three of the podcasts that are on, ironically enough. So.
Gee,
it's like you need the whole. You need all three of the podcasts I'm on to really get the whole story. the adventures of Bavesaur.
At least it's in continuity, right?
Yeah. So follow tomorrow with Superhero Time. And then on Thursdays with Radio Free Cybertron. There you go. So anyway. Nicole would like to. Are you going to destroy something, or are you
going
to build something?
I'm going to review one really quick because it was crap, and usually that doesn't take that long. And the other one I'm going to review is really good. So I got the bad and I got the good.
All right, ready, folks.
Yes, your drinks, because I am reviewing two. Count them, two new number ones. The first one I picked up was IDW's Night of a Thousand Wolves. Okay. The cover looks all nice and cute. You see, like, this little
Does
wolf.
It look like a shirt with the moon and the wolf? No?
No. It's a wolf looking over this little girl who's picking berries. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of sweet.
Yeah,
well, guess what?
The
cover is kind of misleading. You're like, oh, this is going to be kind of a sweet little story. No, it's horrendous. And it's really gory. Okay, basically, there is a legend of Nagbre, which is like this horrible wolf, and all of her cubs that are coming to destroy the land. Well, this old guy is the only one that knows about this legend, and of course he knows everything about it. He tries to make a sacrifice.
Nobody listens to this foolish old man.
Exactly. Because that's, I'm like, this is so predictable. Okay, so the rest of his family does not believe him. They kick him out, saying, how dare you, you know, because he was going to sacrifice these sheep to these wolves. And how dare you? You're out of the family. And while all these wolves come attacking, guess what? They attack the little girl that's on the cover. Spoiler alert, people. So she's dead. And then basically you just see this huge fight with the wolves and this family trying to escape from them. That's it.
Wow.
That doesn't seem like necessarily a bad thing. Wrong expectations based on the cover.
No, I was just hoping for a little. It's predictable. It's gory for no reason. I mean, there's a lot of axe uses of the axe, chopping up the wolves, and the wolves attacking the family. It's just
That's what the kids want. You know, yeah, they want.
They're into these days.
The thing is, it's a three-part story, and I think if they just put all the stories into a one-shot, the whole story into a one-shot, it would work. They just drug it out in these 26 pages, 24 pages, whatever, and it's just like, okay, so I read this probably within 4 minutes. It was just that quick. There's hardly any dialogue. Like you said, it's very predictable. The one guy that knows about the legend, they don't want to listen to him, and they get rid of him.
And is there, like, one guy who is like, we should listen to that man?
Yeah.
Like, he's the guy who survives.
Yeah, and so this poor old guy is out there wandering with all these wolves, and, yeah. So, basically, I wasn't impressed because it was a cheap way to get, like, a short story that they could do in a one-shot in three stories. And, like I said, it's kind of, I'm not one to, you know, I can handle gore. It was just kind of bloody for no reason, you know? So, not impressed, but who knows? Who knows? Maybe the other two issues will bring the story together, but I gotta say, for the first issue, nah. Okay, but now I'm gonna talk about something awesome. So, get out your drinks again, because I'm talking zombies.
Alright! Man.
Okay, I'm talking about Marvel Zombies Destroyed.
Okay, now talk about a zombie franchise.
I'm going to talk about zombies because, okay, we start off with this colonel. His name's Dum Dum Dugan.
Oh, his name is Dum Dum Dugan. Just like
Dum
random.
Dum Dugan.
he's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. There you go. Got another agent here.
Right, Dum Dum Dugan is a long standing character.
Yeah,
The guy that Neil McDonough played in the Captain America film.
Yeah.
Even though he's
I know who he is.
Referred to by name in the film. Like, I don't know what it is about the Captain America film. I don't know why they don't ever refer to any of the Highland Commandos by name in it. But, like, I was watching the trailer and I was like, oh, shit, that's Dum Dum. Yeah. Dum Dum's awesome. Carry
it's
on.
It's unmistakable. Yes. Yeah.
His awesomeness comes out in this comic as well. So he is having a nightmare of the past, you know, back in the world. World War II, and he's the lone survivor of this horrible massacre, and he just sees all these innocent people lying there dead, and all of a sudden he's awoken by this other agent to tell him, you gotta wake up, there's something going on. But guess who this agent is?
I don't got to guess, I know.
You know, huh? It's Howard the Duck.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my God.
I was just like, I'm like, I did not know he was going to be in this, but oh, yeah.
Okay, let's pause for backstory. So Marvel Zombies originally was written by Robert Kirkman, who created The Walking Dead, and it was just the story of a parallel universe where all the Marvel superheroes were zombies. Simple as, does what it says on the tin. Now, the numbering system for Marvel Zombies, if you ever walk into your local store and look at the books on the shelf, you'll see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and a load of other things. It goes a little something like this. You got Marvel Zombies 1, then you got Marvel Zombies versus Army of Darkness, in which Ash of the Army of Darkness is dropped into the Marvel Zombie world.
Yep.
Chainsaw, Zombie Howard Duck is involved. Then you get Marvel Zombies 2, which ends with the zombies getting shot off through the dimensions. It's not a great ending. So when we got to Marvel Zombies 2 and I read it, there's no real ending, and I thought, okay, that's probably about it for this franchise. I think that's it. I think it shot its load. Then you get Marvel Zombies 3, and that's when Fred Van Lente came in to start writing it. And he put a total different twist on it, where he had the Marvel Zombies crossing over into the Marvel Universe, and he introduced Armor, which is the alternate reality operating and monitoring something or other. And Marvel Zombies 4 just follows directly on from that story, dealing with operatives of Armor stopping the Marvel Zombie incursion. Then you get Marvel Zombies Return, which picks up the story of Marvel Zombies 2 and shows you what happened to the zombies after they got scattered across the dimensions. And that actually closed the gap in a nice time loop that completed the Marvel Zombies story. But they did Marvel Zombies 5 anyway, which was where they really threw their hands. This was Van Lente again, so it was still good. It was still worth reading. Van Lente really saved this from something that seemed like it was done. Marvel Zombies 5 gave up the pretense of Marvel superheroes as zombies, and it's just about Howard the Duck and Machine Man as agents of Armor, going from dimension to dimension, sampling the DNA of all the different types of zombies that exist in the multiverse to create like a universal zombie cure. And I it was good, but I was like, okay, that's nothing. Then they did Marvel Zombies Supreme, and I didn't read that. And I think it had something to do with the Squadron Supreme. And while that was coming out, they did Marvel Zombies Christmas Carol, which was nonsense. It was not. It was a Christmas Carol, but it zombies instead of ghosts. That was it. It wasn't nothing to do with Marvel. Just that's all it was. It should be. And yet, just when it looked at its deadest, it lurched to life again, appropriately enough, with Marvel Zombies Destroy.
Destroy. Now,
who? I don't know this. Who is the creative team on this? What
is...
poor son of a bitch got saddled with this?
Let's see. Where is it? Does it say? My gosh, where is...
Probably the last page.
It's probably the last page. Yeah. Frank Marafino is the writer. Is that right? Yeah. No. So, I don't know who that is. Micro Pierre Ferraderci is the artist.
Nice pronunciation.
Yeah. I think I got it right.
That was better than I would have done.
Well,
yeah, I don't know who either of these people are, but this is obviously picking up with Howard the Duck as an agent of Armor still. Then,
I read the zombie Marvel Zombies and Army of Darkness. I read that one, and I read the first Zombies, and I'm like, okay, so this is picking up where Howard the Duck tells him that he's been traveling to other dimensions, and there's this one dimension that they have to go and save where there's Nazi zombies who have...
Of course.
who in this universe, the Nazis won World War II. And so...
And also were zombies.
Yep, they were also zombies. Because that's how they won, is because they were zombies. And so... Yeah,
our audience is completely drunk at this point. Oh god, Nazis and zombies.
Well, the thing is, there's this one panel where Howard the Duck is getting so excited, he's like this because he's telling him about Nazi zombies. It's awesome.
Oh my god.
And then of course he explains to Dum Dum the armor, of course, you know, armor being part of SHIELD as well. And, of course, he's like, why should I do this? And he's like, well, you're not going to be alone. There's going to be you're going to have other people. They're called the Ducky Dozen to go onto
really?
This. The Ducky Dozen.
Oh, my God.
So let me just – some of them this. Some of them I do know. Some of them I'm not exactly sure who they are, but I'm pretty sure. So we have Battlestar, not to get back with Braystar, Bifstar. You know, we had Red Raven, Eternal Brain, Blazing Skull.
Blazing Skull, no way! He's awesome.
Flexo,
like from Futurama.
Yep. Breeze Barton. We have Gurr, who's a human lion hybrid. We have Dragoon. Dynaman, and Taxi Taylor, who's
Taxi Taylor.
She's the one that's operating the spacecraft to go into this other dimension. So.
Some of these things sound a little familiar, but
Dragoon is familiar to me. I just cannot place where I've seen him before. So. But he gets his words mixed up with what he's supposed to say. And yeah. But anyways, so they're all introduced, the Ducky Dozen. And let's just say there's kind of some tension there because there's like a male chauvinistic pig and he doesn't want to have a female on board, so Taxi Taylor has got to show him where to put. Yeah, she could do the job, but basically they go into this other dimension, and all hell is breaking loose. Hell is just breaking loose, and they come to find out how are the Nazis winning? Well, because they have the zombies, and they're using themselves as the weapons. So they're throwing each other, they're throwing the zombies as bullets and cannons, and when they're hitting people, they're attacking.
Oh, God, there is no pretension in this at all.
Well, so some
I think I have to admire the balls of this comic. It's like, we it's know awesome. It's dumb.
But that's what makes it so awesome.
Yeah, I'm thinking that.
So some of the crew members are getting attacked by the zombies, and they're already starting to turn. So Gurr, the guy that's the half-lion, half-human hybrid, he's starting to turn to a zombie. Yeah, you don't want a half-lion, half-human to be the first one to turn into a zombie. So basically, they have this huge battle. Things are going out of hand, and then they finally get the ship to come down onto a safe landing somewhat, and the survivors get onto the planet, and they're actually in their world, and the zombies are actually the invaders. So that's they're like, no, we're the invaders here. So we're just like, okay, cool. Now, for you people that like to take your comics serious, this is not the one for you, but this is just full of just fun fighting, fun dialogue. Howard the Duck, come on! I mean, it's just fun. It's just good fun. Of course, Dugan is awesome. He just kicks ass all over the place here. So I would highly recommend this. And yeah, if you're into the zombie thing. I can't wait to see, you know, what actually happens. That's on my pull list as of now.
Nice.
Yeah,
well, cool. This is Marvel Zombies does have this amazing capacity to turn itself around whenever you think it's dumb. Okay, now I'm listening. I'm just looking up Gurr here.
And
he
does from appear, the dead.
He made with you. He seems like he might be new.
Yeah,
amazingly
I think he
enough for all of the, because I know Red Raven's a guy and Blazing Skull is a guy. An Eternal Brain is a guy. An Arcus, I'm pretty sure, is a guy. Arcus, that's really familiar. Who is Arcus? No, Arcus is the original Vision. He's in this? Oh, shit. Yeah. Arcus is in it. Okay. Who else is in this thing?
Dynaman. Look up Dragoon. I know you know him. I've seen him somewhere back camp. Dragoon. I know I've seen him somewhere, but I cannot pinpoint it.
Comic Vine is not identifying him as anybody from anything other than this. He looks a lot like a Nihilus.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
His head is rather a Nihilus-y. Yeah,
maybe that's what I'm thinking. Hmm. So, but yeah, it's just fun. Like I said, it doesn't take itself seriously, but one has Marvel Zombies, really. So,
yeah.
If you like some good fighting scenes, some funny dialogue, it's definitely one to read.
Nice.
And of course, if you like a little bit of World War II history, that's always good too.
Taxi Taylor sounds very familiar to me as well. I think there was another Taxi Taylor who was not a girl.
She stands her ground. She is the sole woman of the group. So
yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah, I knew I'd heard of him before. Yeah, he was from Mystic Comics in the 1940s, and he had a wonder car that allowed him to like travel all across. Sea and earth and air and land. I knew I'd heard of him. She must be his niece or something.
Well, I'm
this
just
is like
excited.
The daughter of the bowler. Is that
what? Yeah. Well,
I'm just excited to learn about new characters. You know, I think that'll be fun. So yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
There you go.
Cool.
Zombies, people.
All right. I have been championing this book for quite a while now.
Just won't stop.
I have issues, and I won't stop. Until more people start reading Scarlet Spider. This is good stuff, folks. You know, I talked to Chris McFeely about this before the show, and I really feel like he's imparted me with a lot of stuff, and I really want him to read this.
Most of it not printable.
Yes. So, anyway, I'm going to talk about why this book is great yet again. Now, this is, it's basically a one-off story. So it's a great jumping on point. If you've been thinking about getting it, this is like a good one to pick up. Now Stegman's not on the art on this. It's Neil Edwards.
Is that the permanent change? Is this Stegman off this?
I don't know.
Because he is moving over to he is leaving Scarlet Spider to go over to Fantastic Four or FF. I forget which one.
Yeah, and I don't know if Edwards is filling or if this is going to be permanent. I'm okay either way. I'll miss Stegman because I really liked his art.
Oh, Stegman's good. Yeah.
On it. I'm not as thrilled about the art on this. It'll take just a little bit, I think, for me to get used to it. But I think I could get used to it, especially as him and Yost, I think, work together. It's always a deal where it's like, once an artist and writer kind of work together a little bit, you know, especially when both are good, it'll kind of mesh. But, yeah, the art, I mean, there's some bits on this that for me, are a little stilted, but the overall story is so darned good and fun that I totally see past that. This is basically, like, it's like a diehard buddy cop sort of book, but done with Kane. And I think Layman is the name of the Layton is the name of the cop from this. So the basic story here is that a domestic terrorist organization, which is a sort of right wing conservative group that's mostly known for blowing up abortion clinics and those sorts of things, has somehow found a way to set loose a bomb, a dirty bomb in Houston, and Layton is, of course, one of the officers on the force, and since he knows Scarlet Spider, he thought he would give him a call and have him help out. Helping out is not something that Kane is necessarily very good at in the sort of heroic way that you might think, like, regular superheroes are. Because in the beginning of this issue, he's chasing down this criminal on top of his van, flips the van over, throws one guy out of the van. After the van crashes into a wall, pulls the guy out, starts beating the crap out of him and, you know, trying to force him to tell him where the bomb is. And Layton's a bit, you know, concerned that it's a little over the top, maybe, to be stabbing the guy through the hand with Kane's spikes and things. And, you know, I mean, Kane has a very realistic, you know, sort of, you know, take on this, where he's like, look, there's a bomb. You know, people are going to get killed. It's like, we're not, you know, I'm not here to play nice. You know, it's like, you wanted my help, now you're getting it. But even the one part in here where, he says, nuclear bomb could go off in the city at any second. Do you really give a shit about me threatening people? So the cop's like, you know, talking about having to call his partner, his life partner. Not his partner. Remember, Layton's gay. He has a gay partner. It's awesome.
Progressive. I can't be reading this.
It's just a total cool thing that's like not made a big deal of in the comic that I actually kind of like. But anyway,
that is good.
But Kane's response to that is like, yeah, call him and tell him to get Ashley and Annabelle, and then we'll just get the fuck out of Houston. He's like, no, we got. Kane's idea through this whole comic is like, cool, let's just get out of here. So it's like totally the opposite. Like, it's interesting in the take because it's totally realistic, I think, or at least what you would expect out of it and yet what you don't expect. You have this mindset about what a hero is, you know, what a superhero does, and you keep mentally wanting to apply this to Kane, and yet that's not Kane. He's not a hero. Yeah. You know, and so it's very much like a hero story fish out of water, because they keep getting, you know, closer to the bomb. There's one point in here, he's like, he said, you know, Layton's going back over the story. He's kind of recapping where these bombing people came from. And he said, well, and, you know, with all the cops scouring the city, I thought, you know, with you being the Scarlet Spider and all, that you could help. And he's like, what did you call me? He's like, the Scarlet Spider. That's your superhero name, right? That's what I heard on the news. He's like, I swear to God, I'm being punished. Awesome. You know, so it's really kind of funny because even like the title of the issue, Scarlet Spider, he doesn't want to be called that.
Hey, dude, maybe stop wearing a Scarlet Spider-Man costume.
Yeah, you know, it's just he wears it for the tricks, you know. It's all. But so it turns out they didn't have an actual bomb. They went to a nuclear facility and pulled the parts that they needed and then made the bomb in Houston because they originally thought they had brought it in. There's a great another little part in here where Kane and Layton get shot at by some of the terrorists. And Layton starts shooting back, and he's like, "Now be careful. You might hurt some of them." You know, is the but anyway, he's like, "All right, I get it. Sorry." Anyway, so Kane beats the shit out of them. And there's an odd – the only kind of odd bit in here is there's almost like a side bit where the mayor calls S.H.I.E.L.D., which, of course, they're a little pissed because it's like 4 hours like after the initial sort of threat. And so they send Iron Man. And we'll get back to that as being odd a little bit later. I did, and a side question this has Nick Fury and Coulson in it as well.
Coulson?
Yeah.
That's new. I don't think he's...
And Nick Fury's black.
Okay, well, that I can't answer.
Okay.
You're not going to like it.
I'll take it.
I'll tell you the story, okay?
All right, I'll take it.
Okay, right. There was this miniseries there just happened, just concluded, literally. And it was called Battle Scar. And it was about an army ranger called Marcus Johnson, who they kept, they promoted the series pretty heavily, telling us, oh, the dark secret of the Marvel Universe, Look, everybody figured out from day one this son of a bitch was Nick Fury's illegitimate kid.
Hmm.
Yeah, and he is.
Ah.
But conveniently, in the course of the comic, lost an eye, shaved his head, grew a beard, turned out to be officially named Nick Fury Jr.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Singularly, one of the dumbest fucking things I've seen Marvel do in the last couple of years. I mean, my God. Wow. Like, holy shit. Seriously? Like, are you, like, there's synchronicity and synergy with your, and then there's... What? So that's why there's a black Nick Fury in Scarlet Spider.
You know what? I would love to say that I'm really bothered by that. I'm totally not. I don't know why.
I actually am.
I think it's because moronic. I don't have a very strong attachment to Nick Fury, and I think that after the movies, I knew at some point they were going to have to like start that shift over. So, but yeah, maybe this is like the introduction of Coulson. I have no idea. But anyway.
No, I'm pretty sure he was in Battle Scars as well.
So, there you go. Anyway, he's here in this as well. And it's director... Who is the director now? Oh, Daisy Johnson. Yes. Okay. Anyway, we'll get back to that.
Wait. Say that again.
Daisy Johnson.
Daisy Johnson?
Is?
Director of S.H.I.E.L.D.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, that's wonderful. Daisy Johnson is that earthquake-making pet character of Bendis's who's never done anything worthwhile to justify the amount of page time she gets. Really? Okay.
All right. I'm glad I could like make your life better with this comic and a total side thing that actually doesn't end up mattering.
This is not Scarlet Spider's fault.
No, not at all.
Do it by being the only other comic outside of Battle Scars so far to reference.
Huh. See? Good stuff. So, they chase the terrorist down to an airport, and the head terrorist basically is like, I'm not going to tell you where the bomb is. You'll find out in 20 minutes. And then blows his head off. His own head off. Yeah.
Sounds like a good weekend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, to which Kane again, I mean, we come back to this deal where Kane's like, look, we'll just get out of here. Let's just pack up and go. We got 20 minutes. We can pack up our friends and family and go. And Layton basically lays into him. He's like, you know, you're giving up. You know, thousands of people are going to die. Screw what kind of hero are you? Like, what kind of man are you that you're going to do that? And I think Kane replies, you know, pretty realistically where he's like, well, you know, what? What am I going to do? You know, I got, like, spider powers. That's it. You know, and Lawton doesn't want him to give up. And he's like, I'm strong, I'm fast, I can shoot webs, none of which is going to help find a bomb. You want me to stick to the wall a bit? Maybe that'll help. Or you want me to talk to spiders. I can talk to spiders. Yeah.
Hey, yeah, that's a thing.
So that's a thing he can do, which he does, and finds the bomb nonetheless. Iron Man is 27 minutes away. That's going to work. Anyway, that's the thing that happens. So Kane goes ripping through the city, finds the bomb. They get all the way to the bomb, and they've got 2 minutes before it's going to go off. And now what? Which, I mean, it's another great moment where, again, you know, Kane is, like, very approachable in that sense where it's like, again, you know, there's all of these. We have, like, a perspective, again, of, like, what Peter is like. You know, Peter's smart. He's got, you know, he's sort of got the brains to go along with the spider powers. Kane doesn't. That's just, you know, Kane's just really strong and has spider powers. That's all he does, you know, and he knows how to kill. That's about it.
As far as the talking to spiders goes, though, he just remembers he can do that, yeah.
Well, it's not that he just remembers that he can do it, because he's saying that in the phrase. He just realizes that that might be a way to find the bomb.
Oh, but no, it's just because, you know, Spidey has supposedly been able to do that since the other, but never does.
Yeah. But he doesn't really, like, need to, because he uses so many of his other powers and has ways. You know, he has a lot of tech to help him, whereas Kane doesn't. Kane doesn't have a lot of tech to rely on. And that kind of comes back into play here where, you know, there's a bomb to defuse, and Peter probably could figure out how to defuse it, but Kane couldn't, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not really in his skill set. But what's great is as the bomb is ticking down, he just looks at it and then reaches in and rips a bunch of the wires out, and it doesn't go off.
The tried and true method.
He's like, it didn't go off, what did you do? He's like, I figured we were going to die anyway.
Well, so, that is the bomb disposal equivalent of shooting the electronic door lock.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, and so anyway, so he saves the day. Iron Man turns around, you know, but it's just, but again, I think, but the main elements, like I said, out of this, I mean, first of all, this is just a fun comic because there's just a ton of lines and banter between Leighton and Kane. But I think it typifies again that, you know, we're in a different world here. I see it because I'm so used to that, you know, sort of hero story where, you know, the hero, you know, tries to find a way, sacrifice and all of these things. And Kane really just sort of gets guilted or tricked into, you know, doing these sort of things. He's not instinctively heroic. And it's not that he's even trying to be heroic. You're seeing this character, you know, just sort of ending up where he needs to be, you know, to help people. But it's not really what he wants to do. You know, every instinct, every fiber of his being is telling him to run. And yet he's continuing to be sort of tricked, or not tricked, but guilted, manipulated into doing the right thing. It's just fun. It's just interesting to see. I think it's just it's a nice take on it. It's nice to see this character actually doing something other than just sort of being in the background of a Spider-Man comic and sort of seeing what this character can do on their own. So highly recommend you read Scarlet Spider. If nothing else, just try this issue. It's a nice standalone one-issue deal. You know, no big commitment. You're not in the middle of a big story. Just check it out and kind of see what Kane is all about. There's a lot of good stuff in there that I didn't even talk about. So, anyway, there you go. Why Iron Man was in that, I have no idea, because he just ended up turning back around.
This film out this month.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that was totally it. There was like a little.
The thing
bit
that surprised me is that he's not on the cover.
Iron Man? No, it's a really, it's a really nice cover. Actually, it's a neat little cover with like the clock ticking to zero and, you know, sort of explosion. Scarlet Spider.
Yeah, I saw the cover. I didn't realize Iron Man was in the comic. Like, you would think if that's what they were trying to do by putting Iron Man in it, he would be on there. But.
Or, well, if this was like the 80s or 90s Marvel, it would have been featuring Iron Man.
A little bubble down in the
bottom. Yeah, a little bubble.
Don't blink or you'll miss.
Yes.
There's a level of honesty to those 90s cameos.
God, there was that one issue. I have an issue of, what is it? Excalibur. And it does have, like, the little line at the bottom. It was like, and will Iron Man will face the winner. You know, so it was, like, Captain Britain and somebody else. And, like, totally Iron Man's in, like, three panels of the whole issue. It's awesome. Anyway, sorry.
They didn't even have a film.
Not at the time. Anyway, sorry. Chris McFeely, talk about something you think is awesome and Nicole thinks is horrible.
Yeah, I didn't think it was
yes.
Okay. Talk about something think is good and Nicole doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm gonna talk about Mystery in Space, which is DC's new anthology from Vertigo. This is a one shot. You might remember I talked about the previous one shots of this format that they've put out before on the show, Strange Adventures and I forget the title of the second one. One of those old 1960s anthology type book titles it had anyway. It is one of their 8-book, 80-page format books. Yeah, you can guess, but it's literally it's 11. There are nine stories in this. The only ads are a single ad separating each story. So your actual cent per page ratio is higher than your average, or is better than your average comic book. Just so as you'd know, like, you are actually paying less per page with this.
Yeah.
So let's go through the stories. Because it's the only way to do it. The first story is called...
Had to review this? Oh, gosh.
The first story is called Verbinski Doesn't Appreciate It by Dwayne Straczynski and Ramon Bax. And it's a pretty decent start to the thing. I mean, the thing I think, just before I get started, like one of the issues that the last one in particular had, and the first one too, was there was definitely one story where you could just, like, you didn't have to think about it, you could point at it and go, yes, that was the best one in that. And it usually came in the first half. So these anthologies, they had a tendency to peak, and then nothing that followed was ever as good as what followed. This one is structured a little better, not deliberately, I don't imagine, but just the way that the stories happen to fall in it. And then it starts pretty good and finishes pretty good. It dips in the middle, and it really dips in the middle, but it finishes. It starts and finishes strongly. So the first story is called Verbinski Doesn't Appreciate It, and it's just about a bar out somewhere in the sticks where this dude with a massive cyborg arm is shooting the tops off bottles. And we get his story from the bar patrons as how he was abducted by aliens and drafted to fight in an intergalactic war and given a massive cyborg arm as a weapon. And in true 1960s anthology-type story style, there is a little twist in the ending, which you will probably see coming in this one. It's an amusing little story. It's a good start to the anthology. It's a good one.
This is one of the two I did enjoy.
Yeah, it's a good start. The second one here is called Transmission, and it's by Andy Diggle and David Gianfelice. And the thing about this anthology is there is no particular unifying theme at work in the ideas and the stories. The last one had a tendency to... I can't remember what the title of the last one was, but it was about... after the fall of civilization type stories, zombie type stories, or cannibals in the wasteland, or things about the end of civilization, or after the end type stories, whereas these are all just more a myriad of different types of sci-fi story. And this one's about a spaceship full of human operatives of an evil machine empire who've conquered the Earth, who are traveling to a human colony planet to wipe it out because of a dangerous... let me just get the precise terminology. A dangerous viral self-determination meme that has infected the planet.
Huh.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
This is one of those ones.
Tell them the explanation about it.
Oh, no, I can't blow the twist at the end. That's the twist at the end of the story. I can't blow that. I can't blow the twist at the end.
You can blow it, trust me. No, that's
something I won't be doing. This is basically about this is a little bit 2000 AD with the overcoming of the insane computer that runs the ship by notional. Throughout the story they talk about how there's a virus, there's an infection at this colony, and it progressively becomes apparent that it is a dangerous thought-based differentiation that is spread by ideas and communication. I think you can you'll probably see where the story is going in the end. That is followed by probably the most poignant of the stories in it. I did enjoy this one. This one was called Asleep to See You. The story and art in this one were by Ming Doyle. And it's about a couple, lesbian couple. So, you know, there's definite, that's not the only same-sex relationship the story is themed around in here as well. So that's always a good thing. It's a couple who are just not working. And one of them decides to end the relationship and to go into training as, well, it's the entire story is done from first-person narration. So it makes her look like she's quite nothing so much as a stewardess on Interstellar Flight. This is because these are all like future stories, you know, they're all sci-fi stuff. So she goes and trains at flight school and everything, but by all appearances, she is just being a stewardess on intergalactic holiday spaceship trips. And the point of the story is that because of the massive lengths of these journeys, that she has to spend so much of her life in hypersleep, you know, cryogenic stasis. And it is about how her partner, realizing what she's lost, comes looking for her, and then they reunite, and her partner is an old woman, and she's still a young woman. That's quite sweet.
I thought it was a little too predictable.
Yeah, again, that story. Quite a few of these, like, you'll see where they're going. But I think this is perfectly poignant just because you can see where it's going. I think probably it carries a little extra weight because it dares to be taboo and deal with, you know, same-sex relationships.
I didn't care for it.
Very nice art in it.
I didn't. It was just like, because it was mostly just the dialogue was mostly the one gal, her whole, there's no talking. It's just her thoughts basically. And I'm just like, so where's the other girl's story?
I think that's the simplicity of the story, though, is that you are able to read and understand the other girl's side of the story without her ever saying a word, while this one girl being the entire, like, narrator of the whole thing, like, sort of symbolizes the distance in the relationship. You know, you don't, at the start, like, all you ever hear is her point of view. Not that she's tearing the relationship down or anything, just talking about herself and her life, and you get on her side of it and you understand it makes you feel like there is just one side to the whole thing, you know, so you do feel that it's like, well, what about this other girl? But then, you know, it comes around at the end and suddenly this other character, you understand her whole story and her motivation like that without she only speaks two words in the entire story, and those two words are "found you" at the very end. It's quite sweet. I thought it was quite sweet.
I didn't care for it. Fair enough.
No, definitely one of the weirder stories in the anthology is the next one, which is called Here Nor There by Anne Nocenti, who is writing Green Arrow at the moment and also known for her Daredevil run. It's quite fun, but it's very bizarre. The art in this is by Fred Harper. Now, this is about a husband and wife team of scientists, a quantum physicists, to be precise, who are living, they're on an expedition, two-man expedition with their cat, Schrodinger. They're in a small two-man craft at the bottom of the ocean. So, you know, isolation may be starting to settle in, but they are down to explore the depths, and in particular, a meteor from which the wife plucks a little fungus, which is, of course, essentially alien life. But what they don't realize is that that's a baby, and the mother emerges from the asteroid and completely encapsulates their ship and winds up trapping them in a quantum bubble.
Ooh.
where they are and are not simultaneously. Things appear and disappear at will. Things phase through other things at will. And, you know, Schrodinger, you know, can't, exists and does not exist. At this. They all exist in a state of quantum uncertainty, you know. the odd thing about it is that it doesn't really have an end. That's what struck me as strange about it is, like, you know, the couple have the argument about whether they need to throw the baby out and let it go away, and like one's like, no, discovery of, you know, your obligatory scientific debate in every, like, science based horror movie. No, discovery of a lifetime, we can't, but it's going to kill us. Round and round we go, and the story, it just sort of, you know, it reaches a stopping point, but there's no real sense of resolution from it. You know, I got a few chuckles out of it, definitely, and the ideas are interesting, but I don't think they ever, it really winds up going anywhere.
See, that's what That's why I didn't care for this story. It's like, the idea was good, they just executed it completely wrong.
Yeah, there's nothing happening there. Why is a quantum physicist so bad at sex? Because he can fix his wife's position or her momentum, but not both at the same time.
Wow. That was one of the jokes that they used.
Hi-yo.
Yeah.
That, then, is followed by what came next? Oh, yeah, okay. The El Gort, which is written by, forgive me, Nnedi Okorafor, with art by Michael Kaluta. Now, I know Michael Kaluta from the rather dreadful Fearsome 4 miniseries published by Marvel during Fear itself. This is about, what is she's a cataloger of wildlife on an alien planet, and she does some of that.
Okay.
It's like there's a there's an alien beast, and it comes a rampaging through a town. You know, imagine your herd of elephants that may have somewhere out there on the savannah, if you get elephants on the savannah, I don't know, that comes stampeding through the small village. You know, imagine that. And
it almost looks seal-like, though, to me. And one panel almost looks like a seal.
Yeah, I can see the panel you're talking about all right there. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, she goes back into the woods to find out what it was that spooked the creature after she uses her knowledge of the native environment to stop it and everything, and finds that it was because an alien spaceship crashed, and then the story's over. And it's like, what was this about? What was this, you know?
This one was just like one of those.
This was probably the... No, actually, I tell a lie. This wasn't the low point, but...
It was there, man.
It was down there, yeah.
The thing is, the art, it was one of those ones that was just way too detailed that it got in the way of the story.
I mean, it's done a very good job of creating, like, an alien environment and realizing all these creatures, definitely. But there, it's less a problem with the story, but it just altogether with the presentation of the story. The font was a bit weird. That they seemed, the font they chose to use for her narrative captions is a little obtuse.
It almost looks like Asgardian when they have Thor talking a little
bit. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure what they were going for with that. Yeah. I don't know if it's just supposed to look tribal to create this idea of an alien veldt somewhere, you know?
Yeah, that story was horrible.
Yeah, it was not one of the better ones. It's the low point thus far. But it is then followed by the low point, which is a story called Breaching by Steve Orlando with art by Francesco Trifogli, which is about a race of alien centaurs undergoing a ceremony where they face the duality of their natures. No, I can put it like that, and it sounds, you know, that sounds like a pretty interesting idea, you know, but I don't have a fucking clue what this story is about or what happened in it.
It's about horse sex.
Yeah, that happened.
What?
You know, the stories in this are like, what are they like? Hang on, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is 8 pages. The stories are about 8 pages long, please, you know. And this is about this young boy, a young male, who undergoes the ceremony, you know, and he sees himself riding on a horse, and then he sees a horse riding on a man. They will symbolize the duality of the images. You know, it's can sound goofy, but it's not goofy. It's pretty horrific, actually. And the two creatures fight, and obviously symbolizing the two sides of their nature, and then they fight some more, and it goes on for 4 pages, and I'm like, I don't know what you're supposed to be saying to me here that can't be said in a page or two. I don't know what prolonging this fight is saying narratively. And you get to the end of the story, and how it actually resolves itself is unclear, the conflict, you know. And then it turns out that he boned his classmate at one point, and it just stops. Again, I don't understand what, you know, this is
it's like one of those ones, I bet you it was supposed to be really artistic and we're supposed to look really deep into it, it just didn't happen.
I don't care.
Basically, he's pretty much, the whole thing was, he got sex at the end.
Yeah.
Yay.
Had sex.
I mean, for a lot of people, that's the ending of a good day.
But I mean, the thing about this is, though, the narrative explains that this happened before the ceremony. And the idea, of course, is that, like, breeding between the castes is supposed to be illegal, you know, hires and lures, whatever, and that's supposed to all be, you know. And then, but they did it. It was social suicide, and then she bites him. I don't know why. And if you go back, you can see he's got the bite on his neck earlier in the story. And then it's like hipster horseman. You and I are having the first real thought in centuries, he says. And I'm like, yeah, and I bet you were doing it before everyone else was, too, and it was cool. Four pairs of leg warmers. I don't. You know, maybe there's something deep in this that I'm not seeing, but absolutely the low point of the book. Fortunately, then, it was followed by a lovely one. Now, this one was called... Let me get to the end. This one was a good... The title of this was Contact High. This was by Robert Rohde, who has done various Thor things. You probably know him best from the point one issue of Journey into Mystery from last year, just for stuff we would have talked about on this show, with art by Sebastian Fiumara, who I don't know too well, but I do know I've seen his art before. I think it was in the Spider Island New York one-shot where I was particularly impressed by the time I remember seeing it and thinking, ooh, I'd like to see more from this guy. So this story is about, this is the other story that deals with non-traditional relationships in that it is about a gay couple who welcome a third man into their relationship. And they all together sign up for space flight together. The idea is that the lead character here has he narrates the whole thing, as tends to be the tendency with all the stories in this. He has, since he was a child, wanted to be an astronaut, but the industry had given up on manned space flight by the time of his adulthood because of the massive field of debris that surrounds Earth from our careless, dirty ways. So as close as anyone gets to space flight is small three-man teams going up there to incinerate the wreckage periodically to try and clear a way out of it. So he goes up with his two partners, and then everyone's okay with this because three guys in tight quarters, strangers getting along is one of the big concerns about it, so everyone's okay with it. And off they go, but yeah, I know how these things turn out. someone eventually starts feeling left out, shall we say.
So sad. Now,
we see in his youth that he had a tendency, you know, his parents watch him as he plays in a cardboard box with it as a spaceship, you know, and he's talking to his co-pilot that's not there. So whenever he starts claiming that he's picking up signals, and the other characters question him, and his first-person narration, we follow that, and he's just, there's no question that he believes it's real, but we as readers are like, I don't know. And then I can't really tell you the way it ends in this one, but suffice it to say, it's not a pretty ending, but it's definitely one of the better stories in the book again.
I guess this is the other one that I did enjoy.
I thought it might be. It is. This is good stuff. I have to say, though, I think... we're not at the end yet. There's one. The next one here is called The Dream Pool, which is by Kevin McCarthy with art by Kyle Baker. But frankly, it's Kyle Baker... like by way of Sergio Aragonés. It's a bit wild and cartoonish, but it is about a team of scientists who head off to an alien world which lies in a neutral zone, so they have to meet up with the other alien race that borders that zone and discuss what to do about the discovery that they found there, which is a strange kind of liquid that seems to it's a little hard to describe, but basically they think they may have found the font of evolution from whence life sprang, but things go a little wrong as its effects prove to be disturbingly transformative, and it has the really obligatory twist ending that you'll probably see coming. It's the obligatory a morally ambiguous scientist with principle with a duty to her work before morality, and the little twist at the end as well of what the liquid actually turns out to be is somewhat amusing. But the art in this one is what's really throwing it off. Kyle Baker is probably pretty good, but this is some very loose scribbly. It's not bad, but I just don't think
it kind of has like the Teen Titan feel to it, like if they were starting to do the storyboard for Teen Titan.
This is like almost loose sort of storyboardy quality, you know. I definitely enjoyed this one, but there's a strange disconnect at work with it, and I didn't quite see the ending of this one coming because there was enough going on as it was. But then when it happened, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, definitely in the upper half of the book, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the final story was one that I just sort of had to sit down, just had to sit down and just sort of step away from quietly because it freaked me out a little. Alpha Meets Omega, story and art by Mike Allred, who you'd probably know. If you don't know the name, you'd know the art when you saw it. And it's told from the POV of, well, first panel is an old man who passes away in hospital and, you know, transcends to the next life, where he finds that he is just a formless spirit in nothingness and needs to know what he is, where he is, and what it is to be. And this pink female form appears to join him in the nothingness to help explain. And it's just a six-page story on the nature of being that... It was awfully deep for a Thursday evening. And I kind of just had to sort of sit in silence and ruminate on it after it was over. Yikes. It was good. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed this one, to be honest. I don't want to tell you what the resolution of it is again, but depending on your belief system, you may not agree with... You may reject it, but it was haunting.
It's an interesting way of thinking. There you go.
it was very haunting. And beautiful artwork as well. It's Mike Allred, so no surprise there at all. Beautiful artwork. But lingering and probably will make you just dwell for a moment on higher issues. And then you got to go get some.
I wish they wouldn't have ended the comic with this one. I don't know why.
I mean, this is a real story, Andrew. You know, this is a story on the cyclical nature of life and death, and I don't think there was anything better that they could have ended the story on than this one. I mean, this is a real note of finality and new beginning. I think this is the perfect one to have ended the book on. Thematically, as well as anything else.
Like you said, it was one of those ones you're just like, okay. Now I got to sit back and think about everything I've known.
that's the sort of feeling you want to be left with at the end of the book, rather than have it pushed out of your head by when you turn the page to something new. No, definitely one of the stronger stories in the book. So that's the basic rundown of the content on the individual stories. And like I say, starts pretty well, ends very strongly, dips in the third quarter pretty hard, like that in the middle and third quarter. That's when the weaker ones creep in, which means it has a better.
I probably would enjoy this if I didn't have to spend $8 on it.
Yeah, well,
but for the stories that I got in here for $8, it wasn't worth it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, didn't care for it.
It's probably got a higher hit to miss ratio than any of the other Vertigo anthologies that have come out recently. Again, it's always hard to say whether or not I recommend it for $8. Your cents per page ratio is higher than your average DC comic, for not counting pages of story content. It is higher, so you can't say you're not getting your money's worth. It's not stellar. I don't think there are any stories in this that are at the level of the ones from the previous anthologies that I could point out and say those were the best stories from that. I don't think there are quite as many that make you go, oh, or you know, laugh in a black humor at the twist of fate that happens in it, you know. They're mostly pretty smart, clever little stories. A few of them have obvious twist endings, just as the nature of the genres they're playing in that you might see coming. Generally speaking, I would recommend it, but it is, of course, $8, so that is up to you. But I say more hits than misses, and the hits are definitely worth reading. So make your own mind up. Mystery in space.
Not to be confused with with pigs in space. That's a different
mystery. In
I would have loved it if there's pigs involved in this. It should have pigs instead of horses.
Oh God, half pig, half horse. Half people, half pig. Oh God. Sex and bacon? I don't know.
I can't do that, and you know I can't.
It's okay, Bibs, I'll save you.
I'd rather be left with the pig man.
All right, so Nicole and I are very quickly, for the capital show, going to be talking about Batgirl because there's virtually no time left in our show.
It's okay. Just go out and read Batgirl. There
yeah,
you go.
Go out and read Batgirl. There you go.
Review over.
This is an interesting story. This is part of course, we want to talk about the Night of the Owls event has started. This is sort of the first big crossover event for DC after the New 52. This is involving all the Bat books, other than Batwoman, I think.
Yeah, Batwoman's the only one that it's not happening in.
So I guess she's, even though she sort of
she's
accepted...
She's like doing her own thing.
She accepted the Bat Inc. offer, but she's still doing her own thing with...
I mean, I thought maybe one of the other Bat books would be about her that much, because it's like, even though Tim Drake's book is Teen Titans, Batman the Dark Knight this month is... about him. That's his Night of the Owls crossover, rather than have it go and mess up Teen Titans.
Right.
He's being dealt with in the Dark Knight, and like Damian has Batman and Robin. So I figured, like, if Bruce was busy in Batman, then maybe Detective would be about Batwoman or something. But it was not to be. They were both about Batman.
Nope. So, anyway, you should read the Batman book for this. It actually does, I think, a nice job of setting up the whole deal. And giving you a chance to read more. There's even a neat bit. The only bit I'll talk about out of Batman is there's even a neat bit where he talks about he's going to go save two people, and there's a little asterisk that says, go read about this part and the other, and then it just goes on.
Yeah.
It doesn't even mention anymore. It just goes straight on to the next part, and it's great. Like, that's totally an awesome way to do that.
Batman's actually out a week early this month, too, so I assume that that was released a week early because something important enough must happen in it.
Yeah, it sort of caps off. Yeah,
yeah. But before you read the other tie-ins, you must read this or something.
I don't know. I think you could have read either. I mean, the events that are going on in Batman are sort of going on at the same time as this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think at least for this book, you could have done either. This story is bookended by something that Nicole and I actually researched. Before the show, and found out it was a real thing, which is that it talks about these. The story starts out with a sort of a story that a Japanese girl is writing, and it's 1944 November in Japan, and her school has been tasked with. All you really know is they're putting like this paste stuff on this paper, and what you come to find out is they're actually making hot air balloons. And these balloons are going to have bombs strapped to them and sent up through the jet stream over North America. And this is a real thing that happened. They actually did this. And they in the story, there's another bit that takes place in 46 in Gotham, where there's an agent of the it was presumably a member of the court of owls. That is basically recruiting another Talon agent, and they do that out of the circus, of course, because we learned that in an earlier issue of Batman.
Yep, and Nightwing.
And Nightwing was intended to be an agent, but they have happened upon this girl, and she has her face all bandaged up, and the ringmaster, I guess, tells the story that she was one of the victims of those darned Japanese bombs and one of the only people that was survived the bomb because one went off in Bly, Oregon, which is where one actually went off.
We're thinking that Gail Simone probably... Did she grow up in Oregon?
I think she lives in Oregon now.
Yeah.
Say that. So.
So I wonder if she heard this story and wanted to put it...
Yeah, because there's a monument and stuff set up. So, you know, it's kind of not... I always like when that crosses over with real stuff. So anyway, there's a whole deal where they take the bandages off the girl's face, and she has no tongue, and presumably her face is scarred. And she sort of motions that she wants the bandages put back on. And he's like, oh, no, no, we have a whole new mask for you. And, of course, that's a Talon mask. And we turn the page and Barbara's fighting this female Talon, which is this girl. Most of the rest of this issue is it's a little bit of detective work on Barbara's part. We've left behind the mother story for this, as it's mostly facing, you know, the first part of this, Barbara's fighting the Talon agent. And there's actually a point at which the Talon sort of has Barbara on the rope. She's hanging off the side of the building. And she just sort of touches her head and then leaves.
Yeah, that was really weird.
Which confuses Barbara.
Yeah, but it confused Barbara, me too. Like, yeah. I mean, what? It was kind of like, it looked like she just took her hands down her head and just kind of like petted her.
Yeah, almost petted her and then walked left. But nice, Barbara gets away with a piece of paper that the girl had. There's a middle bit in here where another agent of the Talon basically uses almost a trick, an owl coin, and distracts Jim Gordon and tells him, you know, don't warn anybody, don't call your daughter, you know, there's going to be all this stuff that's going to happening, and we just want you to kind of know about it, and you can't do anything about it, don't try to call anybody, don't light the bat signal, don't do anything. Okay, and if you do, we'll kill them all. So, Barbara.
I mean, he basically gives the rundown, like, don't even try.
Yeah, do this and don't even try. So Barbara checks out the page, which has some kanji on it, which just all she can really pick out is a date, November 1944. Ha, the same date from the beginning of the story. Anyway, this Talon agent presumably releases a lot of, hey, bomb balloons. So we reference back to that. And one of Jim's officers is killed. A lot of this is just sort of mid-book sort of stuff with Barbara, you know, realizing what's going on with the bombs. And one of them goes off near the precinct, which inspires Jim to do what he knows he needs to do, which is to light the bat signal. So he's trying to make his way to the top of the building as Barbara yet again faces off with the Talon agent, who she uses the nasty batarangs on. Because, of course, they... By this point, Alfred has sent out the warning to all the Bat family about the Talon and what's happening with this Night of the Owls thing, as they're calling it. Barbara gets wounded by the agent with the blades. And Jim finally makes it to the top of the building, lights the Bat signal. At the same time, another bomb has gone... Basically, Barbara ends up... sort of tricking the Talon agent and getting her into a bomb, essentially sort of blowing her up. And as this girl Talon is dying, Barbara asks her, you know, you could have killed me. Why didn't you? And she writes in her own blood, I have a mask too. I understand. So kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Jim lights the bat signal, only to find it's been turned into an owl. Signal.
Yes, that's cool.
Which
love
is,
that. That's
a great
awesome.
Part because they loop back and they're like, ah, we knew that you couldn't resist. We knew you would like the signal, and now you've told everyone in Gotham that we have taken over. And even Barbara questioned it, is like, did we lose? Is this it? Have we lost Gotham? And it ends with the end line of this girl's story with basically her end of the letter. And November 13, 1944. So it does say it continues in the story continues in Batman 9, and then it says be here next month for Nightfall. I don't know what that is, but okay.
And night as in K-N.
K Nightfall.
Knightfall.
But no, I really like this. I love how that signal came up, and because, you know, I mean the Talon gave him the warning, and so as soon as he turned on that signal, Gordon just has that look of, oh, shit.
But,
oh, man.
I like to think Jim Gordon wears that look most of his day.
Yeah, oh, damn it. But no, I mean, there's a nice little bit in here with, you know, again, we kind of go back to Barbara's photographic memory, and there's a bit in here where You know, she smells the paper and she can smell the mulberry paper and sort of remembers the bombing, you know, remembers the story of the bombing and stuff. There's another part in here that loops back to something where the officers are talking to Gordon about something that happens in Red Hood. So it seems like this seems to be a fairly well done as far as interconnecting the stories, and yet, you know, you can pick up any of them, it would seem. If you pick up them all, you get more of the story. If you just keep reading the ones that you read, then you get a good story as well. So I think this is good. I mean, this is they've certainly picked up at least, and you know, because again, we've talked like this is the way that Marvel seems to be doing some of their events now as well. We've talked about it as far as AVX as a sort of, you know, read this main one, and or you can read any of the other stuff, and you know, be sort of fit set on the whole thing. And of course, this doesn't have a special issue attached to it. It's simply happening within the Batman books and the other books. But you know, typical for Gail, I like that she sort of tied it into something else, you know, entirely and told an interesting story, and even made an interesting character out of one of the Talons rather than just making them a sort of faceless, nameless killer. She took actually a faceless character and you know, made them kind of interesting. So,
I mean, literally faceless. You never see this girl's face.
No, you never ever. See. Well, you see it at the very, very end.
Well, yeah.
You see the.
But she's still in shadow a lot.
Yeah, it's still kind of hard to make out a lot of the features, yeah. But yeah.
I just like the history part of it. That's something I didn't know about history. Yeah. So I'm like, hey, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, so. You know, and it's not talked about a lot, you know, here in the States. Of course, we don't like to talk about. You know, at that time, the press and you know, the press was inclined to not talk about things too much that were negative. You know, they were more inclined to hide things for the military and those kinds of things. They don't do that as much anymore. So this isn't, you know, I seem to recall that I had heard about this before. And that's why, you know, and Nicole and I were talking about it before the show and why we kind of looked it up. But yeah, I mean, this is nice mm-hmm. stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Batgirl's continuing to be good. I like it.
I do like Batgirl.
So it's good to keep up with. So there you go. Cool. There you go. Check out Batgirl. Check out the whole Court of Owls thing. So yeah. The Night of the Owls, I guess, is where we're at.
Yeah, I was thinking it was Court of Owls, but that was
Court of Owls is
Batman.
Court of Owls is the first story, which is just out in hardback this week for anybody who may have picked up Batgirl or any of the other books but hasn't been reading Batman itself. Just released in hardback this week. First 7 issues of Batman. I thought it was only 6, but actually the first 7 issues of Batman, collecting the first Court of Owls storyline, introducing the whole thing. Well worth your time and effort.
Well, because for the longest time I was picking up Batman, and I wasn't reading it, you know, and of course you guys are like, you got to read it. And so I did. Boom, boom, boom. Right after another. Awesome yeah. way to read it. Let me tell you.
It's good stuff. It is very good
stuff.
Brian Kilby is totally wrong.
I could have kicked myself for not reading it for the start. And I'm like, what was I thinking?
it's really good. I think it's definitely one of the stronger books and that's coming out of 52.
I'd say it's right now it's the strongest story, I'd have to say. I don't know. I'm loving it.
Action is pretty good.
Action is probably my favorite.
Yeah, I hate saying that. I really would like to say that. God, I hate myself so much. So.
But it's a good kind of hit.
I just want to cut myself a little bit. Like, you bastard, you like Superman.
I think that's what surprises me the most. It's just like, because, like, on the cartoons right now, I'm still not caring for Superman.
Yeah.
But
I don't know. Well, Superman's come around a bit now in Young Justice. I mean, I'm still kind of reeling from the time skip in Young Justice. I'm still not sure what I think about it, but Superman's definitely.
Oh, I'm behind on Young Justice. I got to get caught back up. So.
Get the fuck caught up,
dude! I went to BotCon.
You want to know something? I'm actually liking this season a lot better than last one.
See, I'm not sure what I think about it. Still, I'm not sure what I think about the whole time skip.
The first two episodes are awesome.
And the first episode, I was like, what? For the full 20 minutes.
Because I like that they're introducing the new characters.
Yeah, but there's
Then they went back and they just had the whole Connor and Megan thing, and I'm like, oh, God.
See, but they're broke.
Okay, I haven't. I can't. Time out.
I mean, I think there's some interesting stuff going on there, but I'm like, I don't know. See, after this week's episode, it'll probably start to tighten its focus on it, but just off the back of these first three episodes, it's felt far less like it's about like a team of young heroes. That feeling has just been lost as they've been fighting alongside the League all three of these episodes. So I'm hoping that's going to be... Look, it's been 3 weeks.
Dude!
Shut up.
BotCon! I had BotCon.
BotCon, nothing. One of these episodes
go
is
watch
on before.
Go watch Avengers too. Avengers is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. See that yet?
No, I gotta get. I'm telling you, I gotta get caught up. This is the week. Well, actually, this is very bad. Diablo 3 comes out on Tuesday, so
don't buy that.
Oh no, I'm pre-ordered for that. I am definitely gonna be MIA for like the rest of the week. Feverishly.
You gotta catch up on Avengers.
I'm gonna have to blow stuff up with my wizards so badly. Oh yes. It's
gonna be. Is that what they call it these days?
That's it. Yes. I'm going to be torching stuff. Yes.
And go catch up on Green Lantern, too.
Yeah, I've got to get... Yeah, I know. There's a whole...
Yeah, Green Lantern has really shipped up in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
Here's the
deal. On board with
that's
that
what
show.
I 4 weeks.
To 4 weeks from now, my wife will be gone, right? She'll be in Florida. So I will have plenty of time to get caught up on stuff. So when
My Little Pony? Yes.
Yeah.
New. Although yes. I will say, when I was looking for Brave Star stuff, I did see a My Little Pony version of the horse from Brave Star, which was hilarious. But anyway, all right, we should get out of here because this show has been long enough. But we love being here, so we thank you all for being here and listening and watching and joining us for now 101 episodes. So very, very exciting. So go to the website fanboyversus.com. Check us out on Twitter. Fanboy VS, we typically live tweet during the show, so you can follow along.
I've tweeted some stuff today, so go check it out.
Trying to get better at tweeting some new stuff out, too, so we'll see how that goes. Yes, but anyway, that's it. That's our show. Thank you so much for joining us, and please tune in next time when it'll be Fanboy versus.
This has been Fanboy Versus. Visit us at tfradio.net for show notes and to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at tfradio for news and updates. Like the podcast? Leave us feedback on iTunes. Copyright 2011, Radio Free Cybertron.